Okay, so thanks for showing up this morning. I know there's quite a lot of interest in maybe getting out there on Market Street with one of our colleagues. But I'm Christopher Morris. I'm a PI for one of the Midas projects. I'm at Louisiana State University, where I'm an associate professor at the Vet School in Pathobiological Sciences. I am an epidemiologist and a virologist by training. I maintain a heavy laboratory base and use, and I train in the arts of infection, death, and destruction for most of my doctoral students. So this, though, is something that I got a great deal interested in during my doctorate. I developed some interest in statistical modeling for some of the questions I had during my thesis work, and I continued to sort of limp that along throughout my postdoctoral and academic careers. And when the opportunity came to join Midas, I thought, what a fantastic situation here! I can bring these laboratory experiences together with a theoretical framework to really try and make our data go further. A lot of the problem with the systems I work on, which are vector-borne viruses, is that they have rather complex ecologies, a number of moving parts and animals inside of them, and it can be very difficult to convince yourself, even in an experimental way, that you've got the right animals in hand when you're going through some infection work. So trying to, again, bound that with theoretical possibilities is something that we're working on now and I'm quite interested in. So what I'm going to talk about generally here is the focal nature of vector-borne virus transmission. And by this I mean when you look at really sort of zoomed out views of where viruses occur, if you look at sort of a globe and see where viruses are being transmitted, geopolitical and continental outlines get colored in, and that really doesn't tell you much about transmission on the ground, because it really gets down to a very fine scale. So the outline for my talk is I'm going to explore how models can assist us with evaluating these systems and develop hypotheses to test, and hopefully convince you that some of this can be used to support public health policy decisions. I give some background on vector-borne viruses and go over some models of vector-borne viruses that we've done. So by arbovirus, I hope everybody knows we mean arthropod-borne virus, conjunction of those words. And essentially here you have a very simplified transmission cycle showing mosquitoes feeding on some vertebrate host to your person, where they're infectious and that infection can be picked back up again by a susceptible mosquito and on and on. This is an anthropognatic cycle. An example of that would be dengue virus here. And dengue's undergoing a fantastic pandemic right now and resurgence worldwide through the tropics. It's transmitted by a particular mosquito, Aedes aegypti. There can be some other minor players there. The main point of that is just to let you guys know that, of course, mosquitoes aren't mosquitoes. They're not flying syringes. They have a multitude of species and subspecies, and all of those have very different responses and susceptibilities to infection. Another example of an exotic arbovirus for us here in the U.S. that could come to our shores is something where my group's particularly interested in working on modeling is chikungunya virus. It's caused a fantastic outbreak in Southeast Asia in the last few years. Again, its transmission cycle is, at least in these outbreak forms, rather anthropognatic, really just humans to mosquitoes and back to humans, can cause fantastic transmission in urban areas. And again, as the main vectors are Aedes aegypti and also albopictus, which is one of the reasons why it was able to emerge. It developed a propensity to be transmitted more efficiently by a secondary vector species. So I like those systems because they're pretty clean, and my lab does a lot of work on those viruses because we can assume that it's people as the vertebrate, and that it's 80s Aegypti or maybe Albopictus as the vector, and that gives us a lot of control over those systems. But my background and the reason we're using those systems is to be able to also ask questions of these zoonoses. And so here you have an example of a much more complex arbovirus transmission cycle. This is representative of what's going on for Eastern encephalitis virus or West Nile virus, two of our domestic arboviruses in the U.S. And you can see there's this enzootic cycle where there's some avian species or collection of species that are being forged on by some species of mosquito, and you get transmission in these rather inapparent cycles in nature. And then maybe it spills over into an epizootic cycle, a cycle where maybe we can visualize the amplification of virus through mortality events in indicator species. And at some point, it spills out of that cycle and gets into things we actually care about and monitor for our numerators, like sick people, dead horses, things like this. So this can be very complex. Again, we don't really know who that bird is at the back of the cycle. We don't necessarily know who that mosquito is at the back of that cycle. And we don't know who's responsible for bringing the virus out of that cycle. So very complex systems that we certainly know some things about, but there's a whole lot we don't know, and that's where sort of the application of models to this can really help. So some issues with our domestic arboviruses, Eastern encephalitis and West Nile virus in particular, is that the detection of human cases provides little response time. So there's not, since our we don't have vaccines to roll out or anything like that, or therapeutics to roll out, really you have to control this before it becomes epidemic, and detecting human cases, it's too late for the most part. So also environmental conditions play a critical yet poorly characterized role in transmission enhancement. You ask anybody, someone's going to, everybody has an opinion about what more rain will do, what more heat will do to the transmission cycle. But we don't have, really solid linear associations between many of those environmental predictors and transmission outcomes. So mosquito and vertebrate animal species are temporally and spatially heterogeneous. So, of course, species occur in some spots and not others in the country. Avians, talking about them as the amplifying host here, are overdispersed in areas too. So, and certain species will not be in certain areas of the country. So. That's, again, sort of ground data that you need to account for. Also, decision to perform surveillance and testing is often done at a local level, a very local level, and it's poorly integrated with public health systems at higher levels at the state and national level. Beyond that, our control capabilities and activities are significantly decentralized if they exist at all. So here's an example of a map from CDC and USGS that shows where West Nile is this year. So far this year, there's almost 5,000 cases and 200 deaths of West Nile, and you can see it's just about everywhere nationwide, right? So, oh my gosh. At this level, yes, we can say there's transmission in many areas of the nation, but if we want to drill down on it, here's county-level data, okay? This is what generated that other map. So you can see that it's already at the county level much more of a focal effect, and you can also see that all that truly white area is not even being monitored at all. So for activity. So highly focal conditions are driving the true incidence. We need to get down to that level to be able to ask what's going on, and local approaches and analyses are needed to help public health. So a local approach that I did while I was at Massachusetts Department of Public Health was ask this for our local arbovirus of the day before West Nile really got there, which was Eastern encephalitis virus. Really didn't affect most, it can happen throughout the eastern U.S., but it really only happens in very select little places. This is the data for human and mosquito-positive pools of Eastern encephalitis this year. What I did was, while I was there in Massachusetts, I had access to fantastic historical data set to let me look back in time about 30 years, look at rates of infection in mosquitoes, human case rates. We also had environmental data, and we had the virus isolates, importantly, that I sequenced, and I was able to code by ear here in color form the different clades of virus that moved through Massachusetts over that 30-year period. So using that set of data, we did a bunch of statistical modeling efforts to look at outcomes that predicted multiple human cases or the abundance of virus in the mosquito population. We put together a final logistic regression model based on this data set that led us to a new model of Eastern virus transmission in Massachusetts. And so we came up with this predictor of a warm, wet fall, a wet summer, leading to large mosquito populations, and being associated with a change in the clade of virus being transmitted in that geographic location. These two tended to predict increased virus amplification, which of course leads to spillover in the human population. What the statistical modeling effort let us do, though, was say, instead of having to monitor mosquito populations in real time and wait for them to accrue and wait for virus to accrue in those populations, whereby you lose your response time, okay? By the time you have virus in the mosquito population, you don't have any time left to control that population before it gets into people. What we suggested here is that you can do some additional work here by sequencing your first virus isolates of the year, determine whether or not you have a change in the predominant genotype, and that gives you some additional ability to say this may be a worse year because we have a new virus or not. So that was a rather rewarding experience based entirely on data. Why don't we do this for West Nile virus? Well, we have significant gaps in knowledge, and some of the things that are holding us back in being able to do things like this for West Nile is a lack of historical data. So West Nile only got here in 99. It's still undergoing stabilization, I would suggest. We don't, you know, yes, it's all over the nation. There's certainly some places that seem to be more likely to support transmission than others, but it's nothing I'd say suggest is in a stable enzootic transmission niche yet. So again, detection of human cases provide little response time. Because from what we've seen so far in surveillance data, human cases are essentially overlapping positive mosquito pool data where that's being collected. Again, environmental conditions play the critical uncharacterized role, and these are some of the things that we need to explore through some of this theoretical modeling. So here's West Nile in 2012. At the county level, you can see all the pink counties there are ones that have human cases. Again, showing it is definitely widespread, but there are pockets of transmission. When you look at the mosquito surveillance picture, you can see that there's a whole lot of mosquito data being collected in areas where you don't have human cases, and there's a whole lot of human cases being detected where you don't have or a lack of human cases in some areas where you have a whole lot of mosquito data coming in. So when we drill down to where I live in Louisiana, look at the same thing. Here's your human case data, and you can see the histogram for human cases for this season. And you can see it's widespread all over the state. You look at our mosquito surveillance data, it's really mainly focused in the southern half of the state. And a whole lot of our human case load is coming from areas where we don't even have mosquito surveillance here. Okay, so we're not able to put together that rich data set necessarily, where we can start to try and correlate mosquito population, mosquito positivity, and human caseload. The little map there with the orange parish coloration on it shows you where mosquito surveillance is actually being done. So you can see this is a local decision. Only some counties decide to monitor for these things. Fewer decide to test these things. And so we're dealing with a very small and discontinuous data set spatially that we're trying to then connect with this one, the human set. So we don't have a perfect data set. We're not going to have one probably for many years, but that's no reason not to try and explore this problem. And so by using some modeling efforts, we can ask some questions about whether or not certain hypothetical factors can help explain some of the differences, some of the variation in transmission rates we're seeing. And so here we're using compartmentalized models for the vertebrate of susceptible, exposed, infectious, and recovered classes, and a mosquito susceptible, exposed, and infectious because they don't recover from the infection. They're infected for life. Essentially, these classes You enter and leave them at certain events and at certain rates over time. Okay, and some of these are about when you're exposed to a pathogen, when you recover from a pathogen, whether or not you die, are all events that can cause you to go between these compartments. So we can account for this. This is a pretty simplistic set of equations that that account for the goings in and goings out of these compartments here. Don't squint at it too long. I'm going to take it off now. Don't worry about it. You don't have to remember it for the rest of the talk. But essentially what we're doing with those equations is moving vertebrates and mosquitoes through those classes, through those compartments, and we need to allow them to interact, have contact with each other, because that's the transmission event. Now, the output we're interested in this effort is looking at something called the basic reproductive number, a measure of transmission potential. And it's a measure of how quickly that that virus is going to move through this population. In this case, we're talking about a totally susceptible population, which is an assumption we're using at this point. Vectorial capacity is another measure, and that's really for, it's sort of the basic reproductive number for the pathogen within the mosquito population. So to calculate the basic reproductive number from these compartmentalized models, we're using a next generation matrix. And essentially, again, this gives us the ability to capture through those equations the event where you have a probability of mosquito in the exposed class moves to the infectious class and has a probability of infecting a susceptible bird. Okay, so that's the relationship there. You have to have a mosquito becomes infectious, bites a susceptible bird, and in the other direction, the probability of a bird in the exposed class becomes infectious, and that infection is acquired by a susceptible mosquito. So how we build that out of that series of equations I showed you is we take, with that definition for the next generation matrix, we can just take out these rates of change that help us move between these compartments. So the red boxes here are the probability of the mosquito in the E class moves to the I class from exposed to infectious. Down here, we have the probability of infecting a susceptible bird for a certain period of time. Oh, sorry, for a susceptible bird. And here's the period of time that you're infectious to infect that susceptible bird. So we pull those parameters out, and we have the equation at the bottom there that that gives us the RO equation for the mosquito side of the transmission event. On the bird side, we have the SEIR model with the extra recovered compartment. And in purple here, we have the probability the bird moves from the E class to the I class. So essentially, that minus V times EB is just the rate at which you're moving from exposed to infectious. Okay. Down here, we have the probability of infecting a susceptible mosquito. And here we have the period of time that bird is actually infectious to the mosquitoes. So again, we can pull out those parameters and put together this overall equation for the basic reproductive number through the next generation matrix model. So how do we use this model now to investigate some theories about West Nile virus outbreaks and test hypotheses? With this model now, there are ways to ask questions about environmental conditions, about virological characteristics and vector control by populating these parameters with different value ranges. So an example here for environmental conditions is one of the things that people talk about with a big West Nile year like this is, well, it was really, you know, we had a really mild winter or something like that, or there was a drought and that caused, you know, enhanced transmission. And these are all fantastic off-the-cuff hypotheses. But with a model like this, now we can start to try and populate it with available data and some assumption and see whether or not these could possibly be explanatory for transmission levels we're seeing. So here, a warm winter is one of the things that people have talked about being responsible for this West Nile year. And there's different ways to parse this. In this situation, we're going to say a warm winter means more sustained or baseline transmission in southern locations where you don't have a break in transmission, a winter, essentially, so down in the deep south. Essentially, you're going to allow transmission to occur at a very low rate through the winter, and that's going to reduce your susceptible bird population at the beginning of the next transmission season. By doing this, we reduce our NB in the formula, and then we break our transmission season up At this point, into three characteristic periods. We have the breeding season for the birds, which is happening through in the April time point there. We have peak transmission, which is the August time point, and we have the cessation of intense transmission at the November time point. So by manipulating these parameters with different values, we can look at the impact here of a warm winter. In this case, we didn't see the impact, which is an increase in the basic reproductive number on the y-axis, until the following season. And so you can allow these models to run over time, and you might be able to see it might not be impactful at that very next temporal moment, but there could be a buildup. It could be a way of disturbing the susceptible population in a way that you now enhance transmission a year later or 2 years later. Another one that we've really heard a lot about talking to folks in the field is drought conditions. So drought conditions enhance the breeding of the vector mosquito particularly responsible for West Nile virus. This is stuff we know just based on the vector's biology, but it also can cause hypothetical crowding near available water sources. This would bring birds into contact more with the mosquito and increase contact rates. So what we do here is we drive up our contact rate between the bird and the mosquito, and you can see this does actually impact our basic reproductive number within the season. So this makes sense. It's, you know, yes, it's a simple manipulation of a single parameter, but it is based in biological understanding and data. So I'm running out of time, but I think I can make it. I think I'll steal a couple minutes. Why not, right? So you know, another thing to check is you can go ahead and you can push the model until you start to break it, see where things break down. So if we increase the heat, make things so hot that you're going to start to drive contact rates back down again, we can break transmission here, as you can see. Even though there's an offsetting effect of higher temperatures increasing the rate of infection in mosquitoes. Virus replicates faster at higher temperatures in those mosquitoes. So you can see here the interplay between the two parameters. We can also look at the vertebrate side and look at differential vertebrate competence. Some birds will be viremic longer and have short and latent periods than others. This could be a species level impact. There's plenty of data out there on people doing experimental infections in birds, and we know that some birds are more competent than others to support virus replication. And so here we can make hypothetical bird populations based on differential viremia curve data and latent period data, and we can look at how different proportions of those birds in a population at a certain site might impact transmission potential. We also know that viruses are different from species to species, of course, but within species, strains and genotypes can have very different phenotypic characteristics. And we can capture those phenotypic characteristics by modifying the efficiency in the vector, or we can do it in the efficiency in the vertebrate. Here we modified vector efficiency. This is the sort of data that we use to modify those vector infection values. And so we can fit our laboratory phenotypic data to parameter estimates that we're going to put inside these models. Lastly, vector control, which is something important in terms of public health's response, tends to decrease the lifespan of the vector and may reduce contact rates. And so you can look at different control strategies that might lean more heavily on one or another of those. And you can look at explore the impact of education campaigns that might reduce contact versus control and spraying activity that might reduce longevity in the vector population. So in conclusion, vector-borne diseases are highly complex systems. I hope you agree. They have poorly characterized transmission cycles with a paucity of data in many, many cases and certainly many locations. The generalizable drivers of transmission exist, but their relative contributions need to be examined at a very fine scale, and that statistical and mathematical models can assist us in understanding these cryptic ecologies and help us account for available data or interesting observation. So public health decision-making can be enhanced, I believe, through ongoing and certainly iterative collaborations between surveillance data collectors, analysts, and modelers. So thanks very much.